Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders Fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper. And I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland. I'm your hostess for this evening, and we're brought to you through the good offices and kind support of www.patriotfamilies.com. A great gathering of people who love this nation of ours and who do understand that literally we are the nation. Our founding fathers put forth a brand new idea to the world, and they made a success of it thanks to their progeny and the progeny's progeny and all of us. They believe that government derives its just powers from the consent of the governed. That makes us the nation, ladies and gentlemen. Not buildings, not highways, not congressmen, not presidents, not representatives, but us. The people out there in BTR land, the folks in the chat room, the guy behind the register in the convenience store, the teachers in our schools, and the children who listen and learn there. We are not only the nation, but we are the government. Tonight's topic, teaching to the test, explores how do we create ourselves and continue to recreate ourselves as individuals who are worthy to self-govern. We cannot govern ourselves as a nation if we do not govern ourselves as individuals. Part of what our schools are designed to do, or at least expected to do, is to provide our children with the skills they will need to become functioning citizens, both materially in the work world, intellectually in the world of ideas, and spiritually in the sense that we have responsibilities that go with our freedoms. Our public schools are supposed to model all of these aspects of what being an American citizen is. Right now, however, they're under a tremendous amount of pressure to do the impossible. According to the Department of Education's interpretation of the Americans with Disabilities Act, as it pertains to education, everyone, every child, deserves a free, appropriate public education. What this boils down to in non-education speak is that every child should be given the education in a style and manner that fits that child's individual learning needs and learning patterns and styles. I was having an interesting talk with my friend Mr. Magic yesterday regarding the difference in learning styles. Our public education system is being told that it must take these into consideration and teach in as many styles as there are children in the classroom. The two most recognizable styles of learning are those who learn from reading, those who learn from books, and those who learn hands-on by being shown something and by actually doing an activity, physically doing it, so that they can understand how it relates within itself and to other aspects of their education. These two styles are obviously very, very different. It's very hard for someone who communicates, for someone to communicate if the learning style of the person they're attempting to teach is wildly different from their own. Teachers are being told that they must be experts in every possible ramification of learning styles so that they can present academic material individualized to each child's needs in a classroom of anywhere from 20 to 40 children. In addition to this, the Federal Department of Education, through No Child Left Behind, has also mandated that states must set objective academic standards so that we have an actual understanding of what an 8th grade education, a 12th grade education means in terms of what skills the student is supposed to have mastered at that time. These two requirements are almost mutually exclusive. Those objective standards right now are based chronologically. In other words, a child is supposed to proceed from first grade to second grade to third grade, etc., so that they remain with their peers in age. Unfortunately, not every child learns at the same pace or obviously in the same style. So the child who learns well and has book learning strengths may sail through with no problem, but the child who needs hands-on teaching will need more of the teacher's time and very different approaches to learning concepts such as fractions. A person with a hands-on learning style would be much more comfortable and more conversant and more likely to remember fractions if he worked with wooden puzzles that were cut into eighths and fourths, and so that he could see that one whole pie or box had four equal size quarters, and that if you had two whole pies, each cut into four equal size pieces, and another open space where you could make some more pies, you could take one of those pies and break it up into pieces, and you'd have something to subtract with. This type of learning works very well for the hands-on child. This type is what John Dewey proposed in his rampant reformer's instinct of our public education. He believed that everybody learns better this way. He was wrong. I'm sorry, he was wrong. Everybody doesn't. Many people do, but everyone doesn't. In addition to this blanket approach to children as if they were easily recognizable amoebas who change shape and reproduce at exactly the right time all the time, all of them, everybody, if he had been able to understand that human beings are more than organisms, he would have probably not had his other incredibly obsessive reform that schools are there to socialize us into becoming good moral Marxists. This mechanistic approach to teaching, which gives lip service to the individuality of children, turns around and expects us to teach them individually as if they were individual gears in a machine, so that if we just present the material in 27 different ways, all 27 of them are going to absorb it at the same rate and match one another and reach the finish line of second grade, all knowing everything that has been taught. Well, you can't have it both ways. It's not possible to do it. The only way you can do something like that is to totally redesign the educational system, to put it in a model that resembles the way many colleges work. Quarter systems, where each student, okay, in a chronological age group, studies things for one quarter. At the end of the quarter, their progress is measured. And if they haven't mastered something, in the next quarter, they go ahead in that which they have mastered and take again that which they have not. This means that it would not be standard operating procedure for everybody who is in sixth grade at age six, turn seven in first grade, rather, sorry, at age six, turn seven by the end of the year, and then automatically goes on to second grade with every other seven-year-old in school. Because you're not going to get that kind of mechanistic perfection out of human beings. The governmental view of education, as we see it right now, is trying to put these two totally mismatched pieces of the puzzle of educating kids together, and they don't fit. We need objective standards because we have to be able to say or to know when someone comes in to enter the workforce and says they have a high school diploma, we can expect them to be able to add one, two, and come up with four reliably, to be able to understand measurement, to be able to read the employee handbook, to be able to speak English clearly and concisely enough to communicate with customers if they're in a public service job or retail, something of that nature, enough understanding of the way government and business work that they will not expect to walk in the door, be hired as the president of the company the minute they step in. We need those objective standards so those of us who have finished school and are looking to hire the ones who are coming out know whether or not they will be able to do the job we have for them if they have the skills necessary to enter the workforce and progress upward. Without objective standards, a high school diploma just means you've attended a public education institution for at least 12 years and somebody said it's time for you to stop. My friend Linda says, sometimes one wishes that they could do a Vulcan mind meld. She's right. You would be amazed at the number of students I see in my ISS room who say, Mrs. Rowland, can I have your brain? And I've told them when I'm done using it, yes, but I still need it for a while. I also tell them that I can't learn for them. And it's quite true, I can't. I have a unique opportunity with my kids, because I don't have 25 of them at a time. The maximum number of students that I can take in the room that I use for in-school suspension is 10. And that tends to overcrowd the place because it's about as big as a average-sized kitchen. And 10 student desks in two rows of three each and four others scattered about the room makes for a very stifling atmosphere when the air conditioning isn't working. But even if I have a whole house with 10 students, I can manage to give individualized help. I can manage to explain something four different ways until I find a learning style or an explanation or a method that catches fire with a student who doesn't pick it up on the first try. Classroom teachers with 25 children in a 55-minute class hour simply cannot do this. Even in collaborative classes where you have as many as two, three, or even four teachers, that still means that each teacher has to try to individualize to 12 children in a 55-minute hour. They also have to achieve coverage of a specific amount of material within their subject to match what the state says they're supposed to get across by the end of the quarter or semester or 9 weeks or however your school systems measure the marking periods. If they have, in collaborative classes, 40% of the class are special education, special needs, learning disabled, emotionally disturbed, etc. That 40%, okay, is about eight or nine students, okay, out of say 25. The other 16 or 17 are anywhere from average to above average, and consist of learners who, some of whom learn best hands-on, and some of whom learn best from a book or a manual. And then you have, with your special needs kids, some of them need a mix of those styles. Some of them are brilliant in one aspect of learning, like mathematical concepts, and totally unable to figure out the printed word. Some of them are what we call dysgraphic. They simply cannot write. They do not have the muscular control over their hands to be able to hold a pencil and create a readable letter. Others have speech problems or hearing loss, or they have visual acuity difficulties, or they're dyslexic, which means they see perfectly fine. But when the signal goes to the cognitive centers of the brain, it gets scrambled. And what we see as B-U-S for bus, they may see as S-Q-N. The letters can be upside down, backwards, out of order, etc. My friend Linda says that some of them that I get, they're already so far behind. And she's right, they are. Because along with trying to treat each one as an individual and yet hold them to objective standards, we're also told we have to build their self-esteem, and we can't hold them back because they will feel bad that they're not going ahead with their friends. So no matter what we do, it's wrong. If we spend too much time with one student who just doesn't get it, everybody else in the class suffers because the material doesn't get covered. If we ignore the student who just doesn't get it and focus on the middle, half of the class isn't going to make it. The high end is going to be asleep because they already learned this stuff last week, and the low end is going to be struggling to keep up. And the ones who just can't possibly figure it out are going to be disruptive because they know there's something wrong, and that's the only way they can get any kind of attention, usually positive, because their peers laugh at them when they do it. The whole system makes no sense. There is no way in our current system that we can reconcile the need for individualizing and adjusting to different learning styles with an objective measure of achievement based chronologically through a child's school years based on their age and the 9 months out of the year that they're taught. If we are going to be able to achieve those two goals, that free, appropriate public education tailored to your child's specific needs, and an objective standard of some sort, so that you know what this person has learned, we're going to have to totally redesign the way we educate kids. We're going to have to encourage private schools, specialized magnet schools, homeschooling, voucher systems for low-income families who can't afford private school tuition and who can't homeschool because there's only one breadwinner. We're going to have to change the way we construct a school year. It's going to have to go to a full year of schooling, as they do in Britain, with two long vacations and occasional long weekends, a summer break of 6 weeks and a winter break of 6 weeks, and the rest of the year in classes. This would give the ones who are having trouble more time to keep up. It would also give our public funds a year-round use of buildings that sit empty and totally unused except by four or five people for 3 months out of the year. It would engage more parents to be involved because they aren't trying to stop and figure out what the heck do I do with the kids during the summer. Is my daycare going to be available for all day? It would allow those children who need more time to have more time. It would allow those who could go faster to do so. If we set it up the way colleges and universities often work on a quarter system that's done year-round, and summer quarter wasn't just to catch up or to take classes you failed, we would be able to achieve both of those goals because we would have the time and the facilities and be able to have the staff to do what is obvious we need to do. Yes, we need to be flexible enough to teach people in the style or manner that they can grasp. Because the goal isn't a passing grade. The goal is acquiring the knowledge. I have a really good friend who's a special education teacher who was adjusting a test for a class, a collaborative class, for the special ed kids who were in that class. And the general education teacher didn't realize until the test was handed out that instead of having the adjusted test for the sped kids and regular test for the rest, the whole class got the sped test. And when she spoke with the special education teacher, the special education teacher says, well, this way they'll all pass. It's not everybody pass. It's not a horse race. You're not the handicapper. The teacher's income is what my friend Rod brought up. How would that affect their income? Could they get part-time jobs? If they were working the full year, that would give them the time to attend the classes they need to re-up their certification during the long breaks. Colleges and universities have quarter system. If our public education in the primary, secondary system matched college quarters, the teachers who needed to get courses would very likely be able to take them in the long breaks, the 6-week break or the 8-week break in the winter or in the summer. Colleges and universities could offer those things, and teachers are generally not paid an hourly rate. Teachers generally are under a contract where they receive an annual salary that's based on their 9 months of work, and if they teach summer school or if they coach or if they do remedial teaching, they're paid extra for that. But generally, they are salaried employees, contract salaried employees, not hourly. The reason many teachers work during the summer is they like having the extra money and they like having something to do. Many teachers volunteer to work in summer school because they do receive extra funds for doing that. They also do extracurricular activities such as coach or do remedial education after school or on weekends or work as homebound teachers or do tutoring outside the system but with the system's backing so that the child who is getting tutored is being tutored by, bless their little hearts, a certified teacher. In other words, the teacher has a piece of paper that says, yeah, I'm a teacher. We have to take a hard look at the traditional form and format of how we teach, and it's got to be logically and sensibly redesigned, not jumped on and changed because, boy, this worked really well in the lab school last week, not on the progressive idea of compassion that says everybody is equal, which means everybody is alike, but on a common sense understanding that human beings are individuals, not machine parts, not clones, not cookie cutter gingerbread men, not ants in a colony, not bees in a hive, but individuals with creative spirit and personality and differences and similarities. It can be done, ladies and gentlemen, but it will take a tremendous upheaval to get it done. Conservatives, like me, are very often accused of being, quote-unquote, stick-in-the-muds. They want everything just the way it was in great-granddaddy's time. I know all of you out there listening have heard the liberal progressives say that we want to turn the clock back. We want to go back to the days of Jim Crow, or we want to reinstate slavery, or we want everybody to be starving in the street if they can't work. We want medieval times back because they were fun. Well, that's as much nonsense as I can manage to stomach for the moment. But conservatives do tend to look backward at what worked in the past and what didn't, and make their estimations of what will work now and in the future on both a knowledge of history and an understanding of it. And because we do that, many people think we want to relive history. That's not the case. What we want to do is to learn from it. We want to look at what has worked in the past, look at what, if anything, is working now, and see if we can meld them together to make something work better in the future. This is so evident in education. We have been having, this week, visitations from an accrediting body to look at the way we run our middle school and make suggestions as to where we have strengths, where we have weaknesses, decide whether or not they will rate us as positive or negative, etc. They sit in on classrooms. They have interviews with members of the staff. I participated in one today for members of the support staff. What they're looking to find out before they give us some sort of a rating is how well do we do what they consider to be appropriate, positive, and productive in educating children. Everything from how much data do we have on grades, how many graphs can we show on student progress, student achievement, different types of placement, class size, etc., to do our students enjoy coming to school? Does the administration communicate well with parents? Is the community involved with the school? Is the school involved with the community? They try to look at, quote unquote, the whole picture and the whole child. This is not a bad thing, ladies and gentlemen. It's a good one. Our public education is what trains our children as citizens of this nation. It trains them in academic skills so that they can read and understand a newspaper, listen and understand the speeches and proclamations and laws and policies that their elected representatives advocate, and make informed decisions about who they choose to represent them, so that they can enter the workforce and be viable members of our society in its gainful employment, so that they can enter professions that are helpful, not just to themselves, but to others as well. Medicine, law, education, so that they can continue to learn for as long as they live. Because we live right now in a technologically explosive world. And the more complex a piece of technology is, the steeper the learning curve. How many shade tree mechanics do you know who operate on anything that was made after 1986? Very few. We need to be lifelong learners, because our technological explosion, our scientific breakthroughs, have given us more and more and more that we have to learn and study in order to compete in our own society and as a nation in an increasingly smaller world. No, not one world government, not Agenda 21, but a nation that can communicate with somebody halfway across the world in an instant, and that we can all see how each other lives and how each other solves problems, and learn from different approaches, from different cultures, and different thinking patterns, even if we only learn what not to do. Our world is an absolute universe of knowledge that no one individual can keep up with in all of the areas of science, technology, medicine, law, ecology, physics. These things change and grow and find new ways to express and connect in a matter of months. It used to be that a generation in technology was 5 years. I think now it's something like 18 months. And that's a generous estimate. our kids have to be able to learn on their own. They have to, because we can't follow them into the workforce. We're struggling to keep up with the technological changes ourselves. And those of us who have not been lifetime learners are finding out that we had better figure out how to be, or we're going to be one of those children left behind. We can't use the same model and attach interesting glued-on bits to it and expect it to teach our kids to be able to cope with the sheer, huge, enormous amount of stuff they've got to know about to be successful in this world. The only way things will change, ladies and gentlemen, is if we take a first step. No situation can change unless somebody steps outside of it and does something different. The problem that we have is that our educational gurus, our educational theorists, are trying to do something different that isn't really different at all. All it is repackaged, re-spoken, retranslated Marxist ideology that the good of the group outweighs the good of the individual. And it doesn't work now any more than it worked with Marx and Engels and Stalin and Hitler and Mao Zedong and everybody else who's tried it. Look at North Korea. The only reason it still has communism is because its people are starving to death and too doggone scared and incapable to fight back. And the whole country is at the bottom of the heap when it comes to economic development. Because what it does is totally stifle anybody who has an idea. You can't invent with a committee. You can't create with a group. You can use a creation and add to it in a group, but groups don't come up with inventions. Individuals do. Because it takes thinking outside the box, and it takes wanting to know more, and it takes asking why. Our current system doesn't create a climate where any of those things can happen. My friend just said in the chat room, no freedom, no private property, and no incentive. And he is exactly correct. Without the freedom to try and fail, no one ever tries anything new. With no private property, the results of your labors don't matter. You'd work hard to get ahead, but you're not allowed to, so why the heck should you work hard? You come up with a new idea, that means everybody else is behind, and we can't have that, because everybody has to be the same. Everybody has to be equal. My friend Rod asked, have we always had trouble with kids learning? We have. But the difference, Rod, now, is that when you and I were young, children who had difficulty learning basically were placed in special education classes where they could learn at a rate that suited their abilities. They were not placed in classes with students of average or above ability, with the mistaken idea that this would make them feel good and make the children without these disabilities inherently more kind and compassionate to those who have them. It's a cockeyed idea, and it doesn't work. It's part of, as Linda says, the progressivism idea that, oh, well, if we just make it sound compassionate, obviously everybody will do it, and all we have to do is appeal to their emotions, and they'll immediately see the genuine truth of what we're saying and fall in line like good little ants. Kids won't, okay? Kids are savages. Kids are a dog pack who turn on the weaker member and drive him out. All of the sitting in a circle and singing kumbaya is not going to eliminate bullies. Bullies exist and they always will. The difference is that when we were kids, usually the bully met somebody who wasn't going to take it anymore, who kicked him in the private parts, and he stopped bullying because he knew somebody was going to kick him where it hurt instead of the other way around. And it wasn't done in the middle of the classroom, and it wasn't done with sitting in a circle. It was done behind the schoolyard after school. And maybe the kid who was being bullied got beat up a couple of times, and then maybe he finally figured out a way to let the bully know, I'm not going to take it anymore. Or maybe two or three kids who'd been bullied got together and said, okay, no more. No, it wasn't perfect. Yes, kids got bullied. Yes, kids didn't learn well. Yes, many children got frustrated and sad and felt bad about themselves because they couldn't compete on an even basis with children who were smarter, intellectually more capable, or physically stronger than they were. But that is life. They were not bullied because they were not exposed to people who could make fun of them. They were not put into mainstream collaborative classes that lowered the level of educational expectations so that the kids who couldn't compete wouldn't feel bad about themselves and immediately dumb down everybody else in the classroom so that everybody would pass. It's that illusion of the level playing field. That works fine in a football game. But in a football game, you've got two teams who have trained like crazy, and if they haven't been able to play football in the right way, they're not on the freaking team. You cannot level the playing field enough to give every single human being equal outcomes in anything. And this is what our system is trying to do. It can't work. It doesn't work. And they keep tinkering with the same failed system and not ditching it and starting over. The positive side of all of this, ladies and gentlemen, and no, I'm not a doomsayer. No, I'm not saying we're going to the hot place in a handbasket and there's no way to stop the downward slide. I see too many positive things going on. I see more and more people homeschooling their children. More and more states making it easier to homeschool. And providing voucher systems and tax credits so that parents of students who need special help can find a private school that will be able to give them the class size and individualized attention that they need. I hate to keep bringing up my husband as a shining example, except that he is, of course, a shining example. But what went on with him directly addresses what my friend Rod was talking about. Did kids have trouble learning when we were young? Yeah, they did. He did. My husband and I are roughly the same age. We went through school at the same time. We are both, I'm 65 and he's 64. When David, my husband, was in ninth grade, he passed science and PE. He passed science because he knew about more about physical science than the teacher did, and he passed PE because they were doing sex ed that year. Well, fortunately, his father had left the service and had gotten into partnership and was working for a company that made him a very, very good living. So it was decided among the entire family that my David would go to a military school. And during the summer after ninth grade, they traveled around and looked at, yes, my friend Yoff calls me a cradle robber. I am. Yeah, I stole him. Mm-hmm. Stole the poor little thing, and he's right under my thumb. Anyhow, they spent the summer touring military schools throughout Virginia and in other areas of the country as well with my David and talking about the various ones and what they offered, and he made the decision as to which one he wanted to go. He chose Fishburne Military Academy in the western part of Virginia. Fishburne ran along similar lines to the service academies in the Citadel. They had the same honor code. I will not lie, cheat, or steal, nor tolerate those who do. They had a very rigid disciplinary system. It was a boarding school, so there was no opportunity to fool around on the couch with your Game Boy all day. There were supervised study periods. If your grades fell, you were mandatorily required to attend the supervised study halls. When you were in your room in the dormitory, you were studying because the dormitory monitors checked on you to make sure. Wasn't that they didn't get in trouble. I won't go into some of the things my husband did. But anyhow, the class sizes were roughly a maximum of 10 or 12 to 1. Most of the classes my husband was in had about 8 students to 1 teacher. That meant that he could get the individualized education that he needed. And being dyslexic, he needed to approach learning in a different way than the student who doesn't see things scrambled. For example, he never has been able to master his times tables past the fives. Now, if calculators had been around when he was a kid, he probably would have been a graduate engineer by now. But they weren't. And arithmetic was his downfall, not mathematics. The concepts are, you know, clear as a bell to him. He never has been able to understand why people don't understand fractions, decimals, and percent, because they all mean the same thing. It was the actual numbers. He'd add and he'd get 23 and he'd put down the 2 and carry the 3 because he saw 23 the other way around. So in algebra, for example, that just didn't make any sense to him at all. His professor taught him as much of the basics of an equation and had him memorize all of the Roman emperors in order and their wives as extracurricular activity. No, it didn't teach him algebra, but boy, it did a great job on improving his ability to memorize. As did Fishburne. Every cadet was required to memorize the headlines in the newspaper every morning and be able to recite it when called upon by an upperclassman to do so, including the weather report. They had to bump up on that before they even went to breakfast. Our kids don't get memory training anymore. When I was in school and when David was, we memorized practically everything. And I went to Catholic school, which meant we memorized practically everything plus the catechism in about 40 different prayers. Memory is part of education and knowledge. If you don't memorize certain things, they go away. And if you don't memorize or remember your times tables, you are going to be up the proverbial creek without the proverbial paddle when you try to do division or fractions or decimals or percentages or scientific notation, for heaven's sake. They talk about our kids being bottom of the heap among developed nations in math and science. Part of the reason is because math and science require a good memory. They require a logical approach. They require the ability to do step-by-step work and not expect an easy button instant answer. Our kids are so addicted to calculators that I have students who are passing Algebra 1 who pull out their calculator to subtract 10 minus 7. Yes, I'm ranting and raving. It's not because they can't do it, ladies and gentlemen. It's because they're not required to. How many people do you know would go out with a pair of scissors to cut the lawn simply because it looked like it might be fun? Nobody I know. We want labor-saving devices. We want the easy button. We want our lives to be faster and more instant. This is not bad at all, ladies and gentlemen. But when we assume that it applies to every aspect of our life and that it is a right, then it becomes a bad instead of a good. Our children are being taught that they don't have to work at anything. That if it's too hard, well, we'll help you and do it for you so you won't feel bad. I have kids in my classroom who can and do learn because I tell them I can't learn for them and no, I'm not going to do it for you. No, I am not going to read it out loud to you. No, I am not going to walk over and point to the answer and let you copy it word for word without having read the section of the book the question is about. Yes, if you don't know how to spell something, ask me and I will spell it out for you. Yes, if you don't know what a word means or how to spell it, I will tell you what it means because you can't look it up in a dictionary if you don't know how to spell it. That's another thing that people do is they tell somebody to go look something up in the dictionary when they can't freaking spell. You can't find it. My friend Linda asked, how are people hiring these kids and coping with this? Well, first of all, they're hiring them and firing them. Or they're not hiring them in the first place. A couple of weeks ago, I was having lunch in the teacher's lounge, and our director of the food services was there, too. And she and the head of the cafeteria staff were talking about the job interviews they had held for positions that were going to be available for next year. And one of the applicants, they had all the applicants stand with a cash drawer. And then they told them, okay, the student gives you $5, lunch is $2.25, how much change would they get back? And one of the girls that was interviewing for the job said, well, where's the calculator? And they said, no, you can't use a calculator. You have to do it in your head. And she said, well, I guess I don't want this job. Bye. Oh, this is systemic. It is a plague. My friend Chuck and Linda mentioned the Occupy Wall Street people, the occupiers. It's the same mentality that says, I want to do away with capitalism and money, but I want to go out and buy a big screen TV. Now, how on earth are you going to manage that? Capitalism is bad. Everybody's equal. Everybody should have the same thing. What do you mean I should give part of my A to the guy who's got an F? I worked for this A. Well, isn't that everybody the same? No, no, it doesn't count with grades. It only counts with money. The inability of our school system to function in any positive way. The only kids who get anything out of the school system are the ones who would get something out of it if you stuck them in a parking lot with a computer and a library. And the occasional person to come by and wake them up because they studied too long and they fell asleep over the computer screen. It doesn't matter what the schools do to a person who likes learning for its own sake. They're going to learn no matter what. They're going to go to the public library. They're going to read the backs of cereal boxes. They're going to ask questions. They're going to talk to people who know more than they do and learn from them. It's the great center, the middle. The people who are of average or slightly above or slightly below average in intelligence quotient and in learning skills. These are the backbone of the nation. These are the people who may not be the brilliant scientists like Stephen Hawking, the theoretical physicists like Einstein, or the incredible pioneers in medicine like Jonas Salk, or the brilliant statesman like George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, or the great writer like Dumas or Victor Hugo or even Stephen King. These are the people who are going to be managers of the retail departments or heads of the shops that fix your car, or the owners of the air conditioning company that comes out and fixes your air conditioner when it's 90 degrees and you can't sleep, or the guy who crawls under the house to fix the plumbing, or the people who drive the buses or the trains, or who unload the coal cars, or who work in every possible kind of job that keeps this country going and provides the incredible riches that we take for granted. And if those people are being told that they don't have to work for anything, and it's somebody owes them something, what happens to the entire infrastructure of our society? What happens? My friend Rod said that English was tough for him, and Linda said it was easy for her. That's what I mean about different learning styles. Some people take more kindly to numbers than they do words. Others, like me, are word freaks. Numbers to me are kind of like, concrete. Useful to stand on, but fun to play with? No, they're not. Just like I've always described math as about like cleaning toilets. You have to know how to do it, but who wants to do it for fun? I don't like math. I never have. It doesn't mean I didn't learn it, and it doesn't mean I assumed that I didn't have to know it. It just meant that I got the math homework out of the way, get the worst out of the way first so I could go to dessert, which was English and history, and really have some fun. Numbers came naturally to my friend Rod. They came naturally to my dad, too. He was an aeronautical engineer. Okay? mathematical concepts and geometrics and physical shapes and three-dimensional thinking come naturally to my husband. I could no more do what he did. He built the greenhouse out of his head. Okay? I need a detailed plan, all the parts pre-cut and numbered, every single nut, bolt, screw, nail, etc., so I know where to put the doggone thing. I have absolutely no clue how to think three-dimensionally like that. I can't do it. But I can take three or four seemingly unrelated concepts and seamlessly pull them together to come to a way of joining forces and making relational understandings that could take somebody on to the next level. Yeah, color-coded too, like my friend Linda says. Yep, I had them all color-coded, numbered, and a detailed lesson plan owner's manual. That's how I taught myself how to use a computer. I couldn't learn it when my dad tried to show me what to do, but give me the manual. I learned how to use Microsoft Word with a user's manual. I learned how to use Excel for my job with an Excel for Dummies manual. I'm learning how to use my fancy-dancy digital camera by printing out the CD, for heaven's sake, the disc that has the manual on it, so I can look at it and the camera at the same time. I learn well that way. But not everybody does. I don't learn well hands-on. I learn to embroider by looking at and reading the instructions and pictures, not by somebody showing me. And I do it very well. My dad learned to do absolutely beautiful cross stitch exactly the same way. My friend Rod is good at remembering numbers. My husband isn't. It used to be a standing joke when he had his jewelry business and they packaged the jewelry repair jobs with a barcode and a number. And every time he was reading out specific barcode numbers, all the staff knew to turn at least two of the numbers backwards and they'd match what they had in their hand. It was standard operating procedure. And forget phone numbers. Believe me, you might as well forget that totally. And that's why speed dial is such a boon. Everybody learns slightly differently, and everybody can learn. If you have the intellectual equipment, the intelligence quotient, and people have decried that test, but it is very good. It does measure the ability to reason, and that's what learning is about, okay? If you have that ability, you can learn. There are some people who learn best with hands-on, like my example with fractions. I've had a lot of kids where I've taken and cut pieces of paper in the shape so that they could put them onto a form and see that two-fourths took up the same amount of the circle, okay, as one half, or that four-sixths took up the same amount of the circle as two-thirds, or 10% with 10 one-hundredths, and a 100 pennies, 10% with 10 out of 100, pull aside the 10. I taught a youngster how to divide using pennies. He had to do long division by single digits. 9 into 327. I had to count out 32 pennies and put them in groups of 9 and then find how many groups he got and then write that number up top. And it worked. It took about 4 weeks, about 8-hour sessions of tutoring. But after that, he could do it without the pennies because it made sense to him. It was visual and tactile, and he could see that division was grouping things. Once he got that concept, he didn't need the pennies anymore. But I was a private tutor, and I only had 2 other students during the same hour. I didn't have 25 of them. If we're going to give our children the tools and the knowledge they need to continually learn, We have to redesign our failed system. We cannot keep asking our teachers, administrators, our parents, and our kids to accept the idea that doing the impossible is easy and they're entitled to it. It's a lie. We cannot hold students to objective chronological standards and also provide each and every one of them with an individualized lesson plan for every subject suiting that child's specific learning strengths and weaknesses. We cannot do it. It is not possible. It is only possible in the mind of an idiot or a progressive, and those two words are synonymous. You can do that with nuts and bolts and gears. You can machine tool things so that they come out identical. You cannot machine tool people in any way. And our schools are trying to both be positive, individualized learning environments and machine tool factories. You can't achieve both ends at the same time with a kind of system that we have. Over and above the ridiculous revisionist history that our kids are being taught, I had a young man tell me, now I don't know whether this was actually said by the teacher. I doubt it because I know the teacher. But he sat there in my classroom and told me that his teacher said to him that Lexington Green, Revolutionary War, 1775, April 19th, the militia lined up on the green, didn't come there to fight. They didn't want to fight. And that nobody really knows who fired the first shot. Well, the second part of it is quite true. Nobody does. But the first part is not. They didn't come deliberately to be mowed down by Pitcairn and his Marines, but yes, they did come prepared to fight. That was the whole point of the militia. Paul Revere's, by Longfellow, is more historically accurate than 90% of the garbage in our history textbooks today. And Longfellow was a romantic when it came to history. We always go overboard, ladies and gentlemen. We fall for the pipe dream because we are a compassionate people. We truly believe in the most practical way that we are our brother's keepers, that when someone is in trouble or in danger, we're supposed to step up and help. It's why whenever there's a disaster anywhere in the world, who is the first to be there with aid? Us. And that's why when we have a disaster, who is the first to be there with aid? Us. We are a compassionate nation. We are people who care about each other. We are people who want to make the world the kind of place where everyone has an equal shot at whatever success means to them. That is compassion. Not everybody is equal and the same and everybody deserves everything that they want, even if they have to take it away from somebody else. That's not compassion, that's theft. We've got to stop trying to create something that if we once wind up with it, we will wish we'd never heard of. We cannot be made into an ant colony, ladies and gentlemen, and remain human beings. We cannot be machine-tooled as adults or children and remain human beings. We cannot stand back and throw up our hands and say, well, we're just going to the hot place and there's nothing I can do about it, and remain the kind of human beings that we believe we are. We have to vet the people who are running for office this year, ladies and gentlemen. For every race, national, state, local, county, whatever, We have to corner them. We have to make ourselves obnoxious and rude if necessary, not violent. Until we get an answer, until we get more than platitudes and slogans and rah-rah, more than insults and smears, and I did this and you didn't. We have to know what it is they see as our future and how they intend to bring it about. We have to know what it is we want for our future and see if it matches what those men and women who are running for office say they want to. I have a caller, folks. Let me see who's on the line with us tonight. Hello there.
Terry and Patriot family. Hope everyone is well.
Doing great, Mr. Magic. How are you this evening?
Oh, I'm hanging in there.
Good for you. I'm so glad you could make it, Michael.
Well, I'm glad to be here. I'm going downstairs with the wife in about 5 minutes here. I guess you know what I mean, to talk to somebody.
Yep, I do.
I thought I would give you a quick call. You know, what is going on with our educational system? You know, you are exactly, you know, correct about everything that you say, but it is all part of the agenda. I mean, look what they have done by changing the laws of this nation so that the jobs would leave and go overseas, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now you have it so that, you know, if you have an education, mm-hmm. you can't get a job. Even if you go to school for 4 years, you can't get a job. And if you don't have an education, you mm-hmm. can't get a job either. I mean,
exactly.
This is all, it's all part of the destruction of America. And it all needs to, you know, come to an end, all of it. And all of it needs to be corrected and changed. Jobs, the educational system, our government, the banking industry, all of this needs to be changed. If America is going to be healthy, once again, we need to do this, to take matters, you know, into our hands, nonviolently, of course, and mm-hmm. get this thing done. And, you know, you like I said, you hit it right on the head when it comes to the educational thing. And you know, you should be a college professor, as far as I'm concerned, Terry.
Well, that's kind of you, Michael, but I have a better thought at actually reaching somebody where I am right now. It's strange, but 99% of the flaming liberals in college, by the time they're 35 trying to raise kids and pay the bills, get remarkably conservative remarkably fast. And they remember stuff they heard from good Mrs. Rowland back in middle school. And I've had people come back and tell me that. I've still got a shot at penetrating the wall. I've still got a shot at undoing and turning upside down the victim mentality that our kids are being taught. I've still got a shot of making them feel good about standing on their own feet and achieving through their own effort, and making them feel proud of themselves, not because I told them to be, but because they achieved something that was difficult. So I may not see or reap the rewards of what I'm trying to do. I don't figure I ever will. But because I'm an incurable optimist, my glass is always half full. And even if I don't see it, I know that it will happen. Because I haven't given up and I haven't lost hope. But I know that no matter how attractive the victim dependency mentality can be, it never, ever triumphs. It can't. Because we cannot have the human spirit and the human desire to achieve and learn and explore and find new. It can't be eradicated unless you eradicate every single human on the planet. And I really don't think they can manage to do that without some kind of resistance arising.
Well,
I don't see that we can give up. I agree with you that the status quo has gone completely bonkers. And it isn't a status quo, it's an insanity. And you're right that we have to change it. And we can do that if, as I said earlier, we each and every one of us take at least one small step of some kind. Anything to change the dynamic. Make something different happen. and see from there to continue to try to make the different thing happen in the right direction. It isn't easy, and there's no guarantee that we can do it overnight or magically or anything else. But I still think one of the best quotations in the world, and I forget who said it, is that the only way that evil can triumph is if good men do nothing. Even if we don't get success right away, even if it takes us the next generation to get back on track, we can't throw up our hands and say it's impossible. One of the reasons why the societies of the Far East have outachieved us in some areas of technology is that they understand better than our society, Western society ever will, the positive effects of patience and the long view. My husband's mother used to say that patience is a virtue seldom found in women, ever found in men. And she was quite correct. And it's not very often found in Americans, because Americans are not patient people at all. Americans see something wrong and they run right out the door and try to fix it. I mean, this is the way our society has always been. It was that way because of the people who started it. They didn't sit back at home and moan and groan and wring their hands and say, I can't change it. They got the heck out and went somewhere else to make it better. That's the American ethos. It's part of our culture. We aren't patient. That's a positive thing in many ways, because we don't sit back and just say, okay, it'll all come right in time. But it's a negative quality in that if we don't get instant, we sit back and say, oh, I won't bother to try anymore. And it's that aspect that I'm seeing promoted in our educational system. And it's that aspect of our impatience that leads us into falling into the victim, perfect safety lie of progressivism. We'll give it to you right now. You don't have to work for it. You don't have to try. You don't have to do anything new. You don't have to change. You just sit back, hold out your hands, and we'll fill them. If we can put together both that active, aggressive yin quality of go fix it now and the patience of the yang quality that says, I'll take the first step toward fixing and watch it grow and tend it as it grows, we have to be both the explorer and the farmer. We have to have both approaches working cooperatively. That's one of the reasons that our nation has gotten as far as it has, because we traditionally, culturally, have been both those things. We have a society that is both rural and urban, and both aspects have positive and negative to them. And we have managed over the last 200 plus years to put those two very different thinking patterns together and create the greatest nation in the world. We can still do it. If we care enough and we have guts enough to keep trying, no matter how many times we're slapped down and no matter how many times we fail. Looks like I have another caller on the line. Excuse me, Michael. I'll see who else wants to talk to Patriot Education today. Hello there.
That would be the California conservative, the rare
it's
bird.
My bird. It's my rare bird of paradise. Hi, Linda. How are things in the Sunshine State?
It's actually pretty nice today. It's not as warm as I'd like, but it's getting there. We had
We had 90 degrees today. You'd be right at home.
Wow.
Yeah.
Anyway,
welcome to Virginia in May.
I totally get your frustration level. I understand Michael's because I go through it here, local level, state, and all the rest of it. But as a culture, you're correct, and we, you know, being the charitable people and the innovators, of course, they're trying to stifle all of that. And
yep.
And it's very sad when you talk about the instant easy button. These poor kids, they're going to get hit with brick walls because it isn't going to happen for them overnight, and that reality will stare them in the face someday. And it's a very criminal thing. Yeah.
It's doing it right now with the Occupy people, Linda. They've hit that wall, and they don't know how to look for a gate or climb over it. They just stand there at the wall beating on it and saying, feed me.
Yeah, like monkeys. Well,
exactly. You got it.
Sad.
I love Mark Twain's idea. God created man because he was disappointed in monkeys.
Well, yeah. And the Taliban. Yeah, they're all the same.
Yeah, them too.
But, you know, what Glenn says, and I kind of agree with him on this, that let's not lose what the founders gave us because we sat down. We have to not only pray, but we must act upon our beliefs, not violently, but with, you know, common sense and reasoning as
and
the founders. I mean, talk about a long battle. I mean, you have to go even back before the 8-year war of the Revolutionary War, when they had people like George Whitefield trying to wake the people up and say, hey, you know, let's get away from this slavery. And that was probably the beginning of it. And that took 30-plus years. So there was no easy instant back then either, and it's not going to be that way now.
There never has been. One of the penalties we pay, ladies and gentlemen, for the incredible increase in our technology and the incredible ease with which we go through the daily chores that took a house full of servants or a half-dead housewife to complete 100 years ago, is that we apply that same desire for ease to every aspect of our lives. We assume that our technological brilliance, our achievements as toolmakers, gives us the ability to redesign ourselves as living creatures.
But that's not possible.
No, ma'am, it's not. It isn't. But, you know, you can't convince a progressive of this.
No, because they think they are gods.
They're stuck at age 13.
Yeah, and
they've never gotten past it.
They're control freaks, absolutely. Yeah. And that's a dangerous combination.
I have freedom of speech because I'm right. You don't have freedom of speech because you're wrong. 13-year-olds. But that, honey, I hear this every cotton-picking day from middle school students.
Yep.
You can't disagree with me because you're telling me I'm wrong, and you can't tell me that. It's my opinion.
It's like you can't reason with a progressive or a statist or whatever you want to call it.
Or a middle school student either, trust me.
Yeah. That's why God invented the paddle.
Yeah, and people like me who have the patience not to kill them and continue to talk to them. The number of times that I have seen a student who has, for example, a student who's a behavioral problem who has a one-on-one aide, and the aide gets nowhere, and in my classroom they behave as if they were perfect gentlemen.
Wow.
Because I don't accommodate to anybody. They got to obey the same rules as everybody else in the room.
Good for you. Well, you know, when you talk about trying to restore what we're supposed to be, first you have to know what we came from, you know, with the founders, with the Declaration, and et cetera, that rule of law, the inalienable rights, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And because of the failed system and because of the progressives and the, you know, the commies that have infiltrated and indoctrinated so badly and destroyed the school books, destroyed any incentive to learn, I am shocked that the parents, since it's been going on for so long, then the parents are also deprived of that knowledge as well. Because
they are.
Until I started reading my choice of books, written by absolute wonderful historians and scholars, I didn't know this stuff either. But it's out there. It is out there.
Of course it is. Well,
it's just the will to get it.
Just the fact that I had a kid, I can't remember what it was, today or yesterday, who really had, this was a sixth grader, granted, but they were doing a special activity today during our added ROAR period. ROAR stands for the initials of respect, order, attitude, and responsibility, which are the watchwords our students are supposed to travel with. And they pick that because our sports teams are the Lions, you know. Anyway, this extra period of a half an hour between first mod and second full mod, is called ROAR time, and they use that time for remediation, they use it for class meetings, they use it for special subjects, they use it for clubs, they use it for anti-bullying situations, class discussions, and whatever. Well, today's, for all the classes, was understanding what deception is. And this sixth grader had no clue what deception meant. No idea what it meant to deceive somebody.
Wow.
Uh-huh. And this is not a... He's not a stupid kid. He comes from well-educated parents. But the limited vocabularies and limited conceptualization skills that these mm-hmm. kids have, because everything has been watered down. If you take a look at the history book, any textbook that these kids are using, every page is about one-third text and two-thirds pictures.
Good grief.
Yes, ma'am. I give a kid a story to read out of his literature textbook. The story was 4 pages long. 3 of the pages were full page. 1 was a half page with an illustration, a title page. He practically had a nervous breakdown at the idea that he had to read 4 whole pages.
Good grief.
Yeah.
That is sad. Yeah, that is just, ugh. I feel so sorry for them. It's the same lack, and this is where the foundation comes from when you're a child, for the work ethic. Whether it's a work ethic as a plumber or a cook or a this or a teacher or whatever, you must mm-hmm. have a work ethic in your school. I mean, how could they even conceive of instant gratification or instant learning or instant mind meld on anything else that would require a skill beyond most people's abilities, such as playing mm-hmm. the violin or playing a concert piano?
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to have them explain that to me. I mean, it's just impossible. You know,
that's the only
way I could correlate that to them and make them maybe think critically on something like that. Like, explain this to me.
What I try to do when I'm working with them, I tell them, I use imagery a lot when I teach.
Cool.
Partially because that's the way I think, the way I express myself, and because I know that if I can create a verbal image for these kids who are visual learners, that I can get them to start making the connection between words create pictures for you, visualization and conceptualization.
Mm-hmm.
But I tell them that they've got to exercise the brain if they want to be good at academics, just like they have to exercise the body if they want to be good at baseball, softball, tennis, anything else. If you don't use a body part, it atrophies. If you don't exercise muscles, they become flabby and incapable of movement. And that gets them to understand it. And I explain to them. I don't just say, you got to do this because I say so.
Right.
I always give them a reason why I am assigning them to do a particular thing. For instance, they all moan and groan when they have to do grammar or mechanics of English. Figure out what subjects and verbs are, know what a noun and a pronoun is, aware of the fact that there are dependent and independent clauses, what apostrophes are for, when to use a comma. You'd think I was asking them to go build the Empire State Building all by themselves. And then when I explain to them that these are tools so that you can communicate your ideas, good ideas, to people wouldn't even look at them if they couldn't read or understand your sentences, and maybe that good idea is going to get you a raise, a promotion, or a better job.
Right.
If I can tie it to something practical. In some ways, John Dewey's hands-on make it real had merits. If you can tie anything these kids are learning academically into something that they see as real, you've got a better shot. But the tricky part with that is they start getting the idea that the only reason to get an education, which to them means to stay in school long enough to pass, whether they learn anything or not, is that they automatically get a good job because they got a piece of paper that says they went to high school or college.
Oh, Lord.
They didn't learn anything while they were there, but the paper will guarantee them a good job. That's the OWS types who major in women's studies and then can't figure out why nobody wants to hire them at $100,000 a year.
Oh, my God. I know.
Yeah, it's this. We have this mad desire to say that this piece of paper means that I can do something. No, it doesn't. Not anymore, it doesn't. No.
No.
The number of kids who get diplomas from high school who can't tie their own shoes. And I worked with one who will get a diploma, and he can't tie his own shoes.
That's so sad. I know. It's disgraceful, and it's a reflection on partially society and the education system. And anytime you allow a federal bureaucracy to get involved and dictate all this nonsense. This is what happens.
It's the mechanistic approach, hon. Big government has to be a machine in order to work. And because it is a machine, it thinks like a machine and attempts to make the citizens it's trying to govern be machine parts.
Right.
That's
and it makes everybody miserable.
Of course it does, because we aren't machines. We never will be.
We
are not going to mesh like cogs.
And the other thing you have... Right. have to remember, too, is I've never seen a small, tiny, limited government run around killing people like Stalin and Mao did. Just doesn't
exactly.
happen. You
exactly.
have to have the giant machine. Yep.
Uh-huh. Because power corrupts. And power corrupts absolutely. And when you have that kind of behemoth, that juggernaut kind of power, you come to believe that it's at your command and under your control. And you tend to forget that, no, it's not under anybody's control. It is a runaway monster, and you just think you're riding the tiger with the reins. He who rides the tiger cannot dismount.
That's true. Good one.
Yep.
Good analogy.
I can't help it, honey. I think that way.
That's fabulous. Listen, I'm going to let you wrap it up. And hi, Michael, and everyone in the chat room. And it was great talking to you today.
It's always great to hear from you, Linda. Thank you, darling. I'll do my best. It's so good when you all call in. I really appreciate it. And all those of you who may not be visiting us in the chat room or not necessarily members of the Patriot family who are listening out there, please call in. Let us know what you're thinking about. If you think I'm saying something that doesn't make sense, call in and tell me. Maybe I didn't phrase it right. Maybe it doesn't make sense. Maybe you can make better sense out of it than I can. That's the beauty of a free society, ladies and gentlemen. We're free to both agree and disagree with one another, and out of our disagreements can come new understandings and new ways to work together. We don't have to think alike to be able to work together. As a matter of fact, if we think alike, we can get anything done, because it'd never be an idea. It's our differences that both handicap and empower us. Like every other aspect of being a flawed human being, we are yin and yang, good and bad, the two different wolves, one who protects us and one is hungry enough to devour us. There are two sides to everything, including us. Our good qualities can have their downside if they're carried to excess. Our bad qualities can lead us into situations where we make mistakes from which we learn. Our differences can give us different ways of looking at things that put together create a panoramic view that allows us to fix something that isn't working, or make something that does work work better. I believe that children are different, and I believe that we should do everything in our power to give each and every one of them the opportunity to learn and be everything that they're capable of being. But I do not believe that educational success is a right. It is a good, and it is a goal, but it is not a right. The rights we are endowed with by our Creator are basically all of them bundled together in one phrase, the right to try. That is the most important and the only human right that we can truly say needs to be universal. The right to try. Without that, without the right to try, nothing ever will go forward. Everything will slide backwards into chaos and ruin. Any system that promises that you have a right to success in anything is a lying system. It is speaking untruth. It is built on a falsehood. You do not have a right to success. You have a right to try to achieve it. Our kids are in a system of education that is not educating them. Our teachers, who work their tails off, they do, the good ones, and there are more good ones than bad ones, who love what they do, who care more about disseminating knowledge and helping kids learn than they do about almost anything else in their lives, except possibly their family and their spiritual lives, are being handcuffed and gagged and being told that they are responsible and must be all things to every child. And when they cannot do it, they are vilified and insulted. And those among them who know that this isn't true, but are cynical enough to take advantage of it, stand out and demand that they get this and that and the other because they do such wonderful things and you owe me. And they set the tone. Is it any wonder our kids are saying we owe them when they watch their teachers do the same thing? If we don't wake up and accept the fact that we are responsible for what we do and that the consequences of our actions are ours to deal with, and that teaching a child that he or she is a victim or entitled to everything he wants is as heinous and cruel as cutting off that child's legs, because it just as surely cripples them in their journey toward adulthood and whatever success their talents, skills, abilities, and efforts could bring them. We have to stop crippling our children in the name of educating them. We have to look coldly and hardly and without false compassion at what we want our educational system to do, and do everything we can to truly revamp, revolutionize, and change it so that it will do those things. Not paste something pretty on it so it looks nice. Not put it in a brand new box with a swimming pool so everybody likes to go there because they can point to it and say, isn't that pretty? Not use it as a form of gratification instead of reward for effort. We have got to start paying attention to what our kids are learning or not learning. What is it that we want them to learn? Do we want to sue the school system because they won't let my kid suck his thumb and throw paper in the classroom because it makes him feel good? Do we want to have individualized teachers for every child in the classroom and pay 90% of our income in order to have it? Do we want our kids to expect everything to be given to them? Do we want our kids to blame everybody but themselves for their personal failures and mistakes? Do we want to promise them the moon and then give them a dirty backyard and mud to eat? Do we want our children to believe what we tell them because we have a reputation for truth? Or do we want our children to accept deception as a way of life and practice it upon one another, because that's what adults always do? We are in control, ladies and gentlemen, every one of us, of ourselves, or we should be. We have to use that ability as adults to control ourselves, to put forth what we see as the vision of America's future in terms, to quote Jefferson, so clear and firm as to demand attention and agreement. And we have to do it by retaining our own integrity and our own deep sense of compassion. And we can. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being with us this evening. I hope you'll join me again next Thursday for Patriot Education. And join us on Blog Talk Radio for all the Patriot Family shows. On Sunday, Frank is spread up with guest host Ron Goldman and Ron's show on Monday. Tuesday, Patriot Family Chat with Hollis Buchanan and Bill Strong. On Wednesday, Right from the Left Coast with our California bird of paradise, Linda Sills. And Patriot Education with good old me every Thursday night at 7. And Friday, Foreclosure Hope with our mortgage experts who can help you figure out the deal with our economic post. And Mr. Magic on Saturdays with Revolution. Visit us at our website, ladies and gentlemen, www.patriotfamilies.com. Read our dogs, join in the chat room. Tell us what you think. Tell us what you see as a vision of the future. What's your mission statement? Share it with us, and we'll share ours with you. It's our differences and our similarities, ladies and gentlemen, make us the greatest nation in the world. And we will continue to be so if we don't give up hope and we don't give up those principles that our ancestors fought and died for. Thank you again, ladies and gentlemen, and may you be blessed.